You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Muammar al-Gaddafi's government agreed to a ceasefire with rebel groups this morning in a dramatic about-face following the UN Security Council's authorization of a no-fly zone over Libya and also threats of military action from Western governments. We're joined now by Rami Khoury, director of the American University of Beirut's Issam Faris Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs. Welcome to our show.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Last night, the Security Council voted 10-0 to impose a no-fly zone over Libya. Five countries, including Russia, China, India, and Brazil, and Germany, abstained. So can we say there's an international consensus on acting in Libya or not?
I think there is. I think there's an international consensus about supporting the will of the majority of Libyans, I would guess, to get rid of Muammar Gaddafi and to establish a democratic, more credible and legitimate government in the country. There isn't full consensus, I think, on using military force or even how to use it. A no-fly zone, attack from the air, sending in ammunition and military supplies, troops here and there. Yeah, I mean, there's a whole range of military actions that people can take, and there is not a consensus on that. But I think the idea that Gaddafi has to go is pretty much accepted, I think, by the majority of people in the world, I would say, and governments.
Well, before the vote, it was already being argued that even a no-fly zone was a little too late in the game to have much of an impact. But considering Colonel Gaddafi's concession, I guess they were wrong.
Yes, it definitely has an impact. They were wrong. It was late, but better late than never. And clearly it's had an impact. The government of Libya has announced it wants to cease fire and abide by UN resolutions. Nobody believes that's a sincere measure, but people realize that it's in reaction to the threats that Gaddafi now faces. He's in a very severe corner. He has lost the legitimacy of most of his people. He's been attacked, faced down and challenged and militarily fought by many of his people. The international community has lost confidence in him or his legitimacy. So the guy is a spent force. The question is, can we minimize the destruction that he does and the savagery that he unleashes before he leaves office? So that's the main issue, and hopefully there'll be some mechanism in the next few weeks or a month or so to either have him exit and go somewhere and disappear from public life, or possibly he'll be caught and put on trial.
Well, I even wonder where he would go. I don't think he can go to Saudi Arabia like so many of the other deposed dictators. Saudi Arabia was part of the Arab League that voted for the no-fly zone.
Right. No, there's an awful lot of mercy in Arab Islamic culture. And if he actually, called it quits and realized that the game is over and said, look, I'm getting out of here. I abide by the will of the world and my people, and I want to just, retire somewhere. I think somebody would give him a retirement cottage somewhere.
Well, the Arab League did endorse the no-fly zone. Why would these governments support such a measure when it's possible that they could find themselves in a similar situation down the road? Is Gaddafi particularly unpopular within the Arab League?
I think that's one reason, yes. I mean, Gaddafi is seen as he was first seen as a kind of eccentric person, and now he's pretty much seen as a buffoon and a dangerous one at that. I mean, the destruction he's carried out, from terror bombings to the Lockerbie bombing and other things that he's essentially admitted guilt for, the adventures he's gone on in neighboring countries around him, sending military forces and aid, and then he's very eccentric. He does eccentric things personally. His politics are eccentric, and he runs a police state. It's one of the world's maybe the single worst example in the world of mismanagement, of wasting hundreds of billions of dollars of national wealth over the last 41 years. He's been there 41 years. It's incredible. Libya is one of the worst managed countries in the Middle East, if not the world. There's massive corruption and abuse of power. Economic development is very low, and it's an oil country. It's got tons of money. So this guy, has failed in every single thing he's done at the personal level, the national level, the regional level, or the international level. And the great shame is that so many Western countries made up with him and then started doing oil deals and trade deals and basically said, okay, we'll forgive you. You admitted or you paid billions of dollars in compensation for Lockerbie and other things, and you closed down your nuclear plans, and we forgive you, and now we can do business and make money. And that's really a shameful position for many Western countries. And I think the Arab world looks at him pretty much like that. And I think there's also an element here of self-interest. Arab countries are saying, look, we better get on board, because if we agree to this resolution, maybe the world will leave us alone and not come after us. Because a lot of Arab countries have similar, not quite as eccentric and egregious and ugly as Libya, but regimes that use violence, that deny human rights, that waste money, that have corruption, abuse of power, have a lot of terrible things that they do. And they're probably, many of them are worried that the world might come after them. And the president of Sudan has been indicted and is supposed to go to the International Criminal Court. And other things like this might happen as well. So I think there's an element of that in sort of buying protection for some Arab regimes who think that by voting for this resolution, they'll be seen as good guys.
Well, you're in Beirut. How is the press handling this story in Lebanon, especially since that country is right now is being torn apart by some very conflicting groups?
Well, there's mixed sentiments here, and this is what makes Arab politics so complex and so interesting and often so frustrating. You have a lot of resentment and suspicion of international military moves in the Middle East. So people are sort of chromosomally, genetically suspicious of foreign countries that come and use their armies to do stuff in the Middle East, because people here have seen this for decades and they usually are at the bad end of this deal. At the same time, there's a lot of anger against Libya, because the assumption is that the Libyan regime, Gaddafi and his people, killed the Imam Musa Sadr, who was a tremendously charismatic Shiite leader in the 70s, and he went to Libya on a trip and he disappeared, and we've never heard from him since. And the Shiites particularly are very critical of Libya for this, and many other Lebanese in sympathy are also critical of Libya. So it's really a mixed bag. And there's also, of course, the International Tribunal, the UN Special Tribunal set up to try and a special court, the people who will be accused of having killed the late Prime Minister Rafi al-Hariri in 2005, the Lebanese late Prime Minister. And the accusations are expected to name people who are linked to Hezbollah and maybe people in Syria. So that's another reason why many in Lebanon don't like international intervention, while others, people who are, say, critical of Hezbollah, they want international intervention to stop criminal activities by Arab leaders or Arab groups or Arab organizations. So it's a very, very mixed picture in Lebanon and across the region to some extent, too.
And in this country as well, the U.S. government seemed to be dragging its heels on the issue of whether to do something in Libya. And one of the concerns is that if we send our military in, it looks like something similar to what has caused so much trouble in the Arab world, our invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq.
Well, that's true. And this is where the suspicion and concern about U.S. or Western military activity, this is why it's so strong in many parts of the Arab world. The United States, I think, has a role being one of the, the leader of the, say, Western world, whatever we call it these days. But the American role is also very tricky, because in the past, when the U.S. took unilateral action, and most people in this region opposed it. That's why it has to be sanctioned by the Security Council. And in this case, the Arab League approved it, the Security Council approved it. Therefore, I personally and many others think it's absolutely legitimate, and it's actually urgent, and the the world has to step up, especially the Arab world, has to stop being so hypocritical and go in there and help out in any way they can, with money, with airplanes, with radar systems, with humanitarian aid, military supplies, food, whatever they can send. They have to do it to make it clear that we don't want this kind of criminal buffoonery in the leaderships of the Arab world. But the Arabs won't do that, unfortunately. I think most Arab leaderships are cautious. Most of them are hypocritical. Most of them are worried about their own skins. And so this is an unfortunate situation. But the fact that they voted at the Arab League with only two countries against it was a surprise to everybody, but a happy surprise in my book.
Al Jazeera reports that France doesn't want NATO involved in any UN-sanctioned military action in Libya because that might not send the right signal for the bloc to be seen as intervening in an Arab country. And El País reports that Spain will contribute to the international military operation against Libya. Prime Minister José Luis Rodríguez Zapatero opposed the Iraq War and quickly withdrew Spanish forces from that country when he took office in 2004. But he says that action against Libya is a humanitarian thing. On the other hand, Al Jazeera is also reporting that the Libyan government is continuing to fight. In fact, they are firing on the rebel-held western city of Misrata. So I'm not even sure that there is a real ceasefire, or maybe the word hasn't gotten to Gaddafi's forces that there is one.
Yeah, I think the Libyans are people, the Libyan leadership, I should say, the government, is not very trusted. People don't believe its sincerity, and they don't believe it when it says something that it's actually going to do it. So it's no surprise that they say they're going to accept a ceasefire and then they keep fighting. We're sitting here watching Jazeera ourselves, as are 70, 80 million people around the Arab world and the rest of the world. So it's very hard for governments to play the old smoke and mirrors games that they used to play before by saying one thing and doing something else. Everything is out in the open now, and we're getting reports from all over the region that come on Jazeera and other satellite TVs, but Jazeera does the best job, and there were reports today of some demonstrations in Syria, which is a novelty if that's actually happening.
And Yemen is in a state of emergency today.
Yemen is in a big mess. I was in Syria yesterday in Damascus for a conference and talked to some people, and then there's jitters all over the region among leaderships and among people. Every country is different.
And Syria has been described as perhaps the most stable of any of the countries in the region.
Well, it is the most stable in terms of disturbances, but it has the similar vulnerabilities to many of the other countries. It has also offsetting factors that help it so far avoid these kinds of public demonstrations, and it's got good and positive and negative things going for it. But The interesting thing about these revolts across the region is that in most of the countries, including some of the oil-rich countries like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and others, and Bahrain and Oman, even there, you have a similar strain of grievances by ordinary people across the region that are reflected in both logistical material issues like jobs or wages or equitable distribution of water, practical material things. And then you have intangible demands of people want to be treated equally and treated honorably with dignity. They want their rights as citizens. They want the constitution that doesn't, play games, that is actually implemented. So they want to be treated as human beings with rights and citizens with rights, and they want to have a decent life. And these grievances are quite common across most of the region. There's several petitions in Saudi Arabia that have been sent to the king asking for, changes in the constitution and more more effective fighting corruption and things of that nature. And this is what's so interesting about these revolts across the region, that each country has its specificities. The legitimacy of the leaderships varies across the region. The response of the leadership varies. But every country, without exception, is vulnerable. And this process has now started on a big scale. But, and it's going to go on for months and months until it stabilizes and new, more democratic Arab systems emerge.
But toppling the dictator doesn't seem to be the complete story. Egyptians are set to vote on constitutional reforms on Saturday. A lot of people are unhappy with what they're being offered. Just because Gaddafi is removed from office doesn't necessarily mean that what will follow will be something that the Libyan people will be happy with either.
That's right. Toppling dictators proved to be actually relatively easy in Egypt and Tunisia. I mean, people died and people were injured, but in Tunisia it happened in a couple of weeks, and in Egypt about 2-3 weeks as well. It was surprisingly fast. These dictators proved to be thin in terms of their real support in the country and in the security and army system, and they fled. Other people are fighting back, like in Libya, like in Bahrain, and some people are in between their negotiating, trying to push the reform agenda, try to buy people off with, you know, raising their salaries or lowering prices. So there's different regime responses across the region, and we should be careful to recognize the nuances and the variety of political systems, of stress on the population, and the character of the leaders makes a big difference. So the Libyan leader Gaddafi responds in a different way than, say, the Jordanian king or other people. But getting rid of the leader is the first step in a long process, because what people are asking for is not really just reform. What they're asking for is to reconfigure and re-legitimize the entire power structure, how the system operates, how power is exercised, how accountability works, and how the citizen exercises his or her right of citizenship through voting, through a fair judicial system, through accountability mechanisms, through pluralistic politics, through a vibrant civil society and free media, a quality education system. All of these things together need a complete reconfiguration of how power is exercised and how institutions operate throughout the Arab world. And that's a long process. It takes time. And I think the Egyptian case is the most important, because it's Egypt is resuming its role and its place as the center of the Arab world, which has been marginalized for the last 30, 40 years.
But if Gaddafi leaves office, I mean, if he agrees to a ceasefire, that doesn't mean that he's going to be leaving office. It just means that he's agreeing to a ceasefire. So
right,
we may wind up with a stalemate in Libya.
It's possible, but I think the writing is on the wall. I think it's clear that he has very, very few supporters other than, you know, his tribe and his the people he pays and the mercenaries he brings in from other African countries. He has a very narrow base of support. And the minute anybody starts using, you know, military force from outside, they're going to flee like ants. There's no doubt about that.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. Rami Khoury is director of the American University of Beirut's Issam Faras Institute for Public Policy and International Affairs.
Well, thank you for having me, and may your favorite team do well in March Madness.
Thanks.